Thanks for downloading this Guardian podcast brought to you in association with Squarespace. For all you need to build beautiful websites, go to squarespace.com.
The Guardian.
This is Politics Weekly. I'm Romina Mason. Parliament may be taking a week off, but politics goes on and campaigning is intensifying in the Labour-held constituencies of Copeland and Stoke-on-Trent, where by-elections are taking place next week.
There's been, like other areas, a lot of migration into the area, and you know, the white working class lads and people feel that maybe they've been a bit neglected on that side.
Also this week, pressure has been building on Commons Speaker John Bercow as Tory MPs continue to plot a vote of no confidence against him. And we look ahead to next week's machinations in the House of Lords as the Brexit bill approaches its next hurdle. And what do we know about Donald Trump's links with Russia? We hear from our top in-house Kremlinologist, Luke Harding.
This is shaping up for a classic, massive, rambunctious scandal.
But first, to Stoke-on-Trent and the battle for Tristram Hunt's vacated seat. The two frontrunners for the constituency have been forced into public apologies this week. UKIP's Paul Nuttall admitted he had not lost close friends in the Hillsborough Stadium disaster, although he maintains he was one of the surviving fans that day.
I was there on that day. I've got witnesses, people who will stand up in court and back me 100%, OK?
Meanwhile, Labour's candidate Gareth Snell has apologised for offensive posts on his Twitter feed. Well, this week, our political reporter Jessica Elgott has been out in Stoke, and it's fair to say the voters she spoke to were hardly relishing the contest.
I hope Labour.
You'd vote Labour?
I'm more socialist in my thoughts than that far right wing anyway.
Yeah. What do you think that... is there any reason you think Labour might struggle around here?
I think because of the hard industry that's gone now in Stoke-on-Trent, the working class guys have been had their heads turned to a more right-wing political view. There's been, like other areas, a lot of migration into the area, and you know, the white working class lads and people feel that maybe they've been a bit neglected on that side.
Yeah,
that's my point of view on that one.
I think it all boils down to unemployment and lack of opportunity and
frustration.
Probably. And I did see the UKIP guys did drop a folder in my mailbox.
Oh, that's lovely.
Yeah, and they also say that we're bringing jobs back to Stoke.
Sure,
so that is what people like to hear. I'm not sure how they're doing it or if it's even true, but...
People from ordinary backgrounds are in politics anymore. They're all public school boys, whether it's Labour, whether it's Conservative. It's shocking. There is no ordinary person that has gone through the grassroots that understands exactly the issues at the ground level. For me...
Could you see people here voting for someone like Paul Nuttall, even though he's not from the area?
Tristram Hunt got in, didn't he? Sure. And who was he? A public schoolboy. Look what he's done. Dumped him and gone to Victoria and Albert. Good luck to you, mate. You know, but there's no way he was bothered about the Potteries. We were a stepping stone to his political career.
To talk about this week's events, I'm joined by Julian Coman, Assistant Editor of The Observer, Alan Rennick of UCL's Constitution Unit, and Helen Pidd, who is Northern Editor of The Guardian. Now, Julian, Stoke is the kind of seat that at the last election Labour wouldn't dream of losing, a majority of more than 5,000. But 2 years later, and it suddenly feels like it might be in play, particularly with UKIP in the ascendancy. Is it the Brexit effect, or do you think something else is going on here?
It's the Brexit effect, but the Brexit effect contains kind of many dimensions. And one crucial dimension is that Labour seems to have lost a great deal of affection among the towns which once supported it very strongly. I mean, certainly in the case of Stoke, Labour has never lost Stoke or this particular seat, which was formed, I think, in the 1950s. So it would be a complete disaster for Labour to lose it, a disaster for Jeremy Corbyn, but also it would provoke a kind of bout of introspection, the like of which we haven't seen before, I think, for Labour, because there is a danger that Labour is losing the towns. Two-thirds of towns voted Brexit. They voted Brexit because they want change of quite a radical kind, going beyond, I think, changes to, say, free movement of labour. They want a kind of new settlement for the towns. So Labour needs to find a way of speaking to those concerns, I think. And certainly if it loses Stoke, then that need will become pressing and urgent.
It's fair to say, though, that Paul Nuttall, the UKIP leader, hasn't had a very good campaign in Stoke so far.
He's had a nightmare, isn't he?
This is the real test of his appeal. So do you think he can actually succeed in winning the seats?
Well, I think it's very interesting. I mean, for obvious reasons, going into both this election and the Copeland by-election, the focus has been on Labour. These are safe Labour seats. If Labour loses, it's disastrous for Labour. But it's also a massive test for UKIP, given that the party has so explicitly decided or targeted the North, targeted Labour seats, targeted Labour towns. This is supposed to be the UKIP that comes after Brexit, which establishes itself as a working class party of the North and Midlands. So it's a crucial test for Nuttall's leadership. And I think that if Labour manage to kind of narrowly hold on, the story will quickly become the organisation of UKIP, which doesn't seem like it's been that efficient, certainly in Stoke, Helen will know in Copeland. And it will become an examination of Paul Nuttall, I think, who very quickly has stumbled into a kind of quagmire largely of his own making, or his press officers. We can sort of judge on that.
And Helen, you're in the other seat up for grabs next week, Copeland in the northwest, where former Labour MP Jamie Reid resigned to take up a job in the local nuclear power industry. And Labour's majority there is about 2,500, and the nearest competitor are the Conservatives. What's your sense of how the campaign is going there?
It's looking very tight, and the Labour Party is certainly nervous that the Conservatives might manage to make the first gain in a by-election since 1982 for a ruling party. A ruling party hasn't done it since then. What I would say, if Labour wins, it's in spite of Jeremy Corbyn and certainly not because of him. I've been up three times in the past couple of weeks and I've met one Jeremy Corbyn supporter. He's just not seen as representative of the working man. And most damagingly, nobody believes for one minute that he has really converted to nuclear power. And the Conservatives are delighting in reminding voters that just in 2011, there's a speech that Corbyn gave that's doing the rounds on the internet in which he opposes nuclear power and proposes decommissioning the power stations. And that is absolutely toxic in a seat like Copeland, where 10,000 people are employed at Sellafield, the nuclear decommissioning plant, plus many thousands more in the supply chain.
And Theresa May has actually been up in Copeland herself, but there's been no sign of Jeremy Corbyn yet there. Does that mean that the Tories are sensing victory?
They think they might squeak it in the terms of one Tory MP I spoke to a couple of days ago. But their big Achilles heel in this seat is a very local issue, which is to do with the local hospital in Whitehaven, West Cumberland Infirmary. It only opened in 2015, but there are some plans which were made locally but backed by the Tories, which would downgrade maternity services. You have to come up here to appreciate the distances involved in a constituency like this, where it can take an hour and a half to drive from one side to the other. But basically, it means that if you have a complicated birth in Whitehaven, there'll be no consultants at the maternity unit, and you'll have to get in an ambulance and drive 40 miles to Carlisle, which might not sound that bad until you've tried to drive on that road and tried to overtake somebody. So it really is quite fundamental stuff, and the Tories don't really have an answer to that. Theresa May was yesterday asked four times if she opposed the plan to downgrade the maternity unit, and she just dodged the question. Even her own candidate, who's a new face to politics, Trudy Harrison, she had her own four children at this maternity unit, so she opposes it. But there's not too much she can actually do. She can't pledge to reverse the proposals.
And Labour have got some pretty punchy leaflets out there saying that babies could die if the plans go ahead. Do you think that really hard-hitting message will cut through?
It's definitely cutting through, and people I've spoken to who are voting Labour, a lot of them do cite the hospital as being the key issue, because most women have had their own children in that unit. But people are finding themselves in a bit of a bind. I spoke to a woman in Whitehaven the other day. She runs a business, and she said, "Well, most of my family are reliant on nuclear, and Jeremy Corbyn does not support nuclear. But I've got daughters who want to have babies, and can I trust the Conservatives with the NHS? I mean, I have no doubt that if this hospital issue was not present in the Copeland by-election, the Conservatives would win. And that's why Labour has basically made it a single-issue campaign. They just say NHS, NHS, NHS. You know, they've tried to keep their candidate away from national media, who will try and turn the conversation to Jeremy Corbyn or other issues. I managed to get 11 minutes in the Morrison's Cafe with Gillian Troughton, who's a local councillor who's standing for Labour. And every question, she turned around to the NHS. She said four times, you know, I'm not going to give the Tories a green light to ruin our NHS. You know, it might work, but voters aren't stupid. They know that there are other issues at stake. So, I don't know, I wouldn't want to put a bet on this one.
And Alan, by-elections often throw up some strange results and they can be overinterpreted. But how big a statement would a Tory win be in Copeland or a UKIP win in Stoke? And how bad would it be for Labour?
Well, it is pretty unusual for opposition parties to lose by-elections. They do it occasionally. And the last time was in Bradford West in 2012 when Respect George Galloway defeated Labour. But it doesn't happen very often. I think if Labour were to lose just the Copeland by-election, then they would be able to pin it to the sorts of local issues, particularly the nuclear issue that Helen has been talking about, or at least they would try to portray it as being very much a local matter. I think the bigger danger for them is if they lose the Stoke by-election, because that would very much fit into the broader narratives about the structural problems facing the Labour Party that Julian has been talking about. So I think it's really vital for the Labour Party that they do manage to hold on in Stoke. If they don't, then that suggests that everything that has been said in recent months about the difficulties under Corbyn and also the more fundamental difficulties for the Labour Party in appealing in these traditional, particularly northern Midlands towns, are very real and very difficult.
It certainly couldn't be a more unwelcome start to the political year for Labour than to have these two by-elections unexpectedly come along through, obviously, Jamie Reid and Tristram Hunt deciding to step down. It's bad, bad timing for Labour and therefore for Jeremy Corbyn. Not got much luck.
Yes, Julian, I was going to ask, what do you think the future would hold for Jeremy Corbyn if either of these seats are lost? Do you think he's in any danger at all, having just won a huge majority in the leadership contest only this autumn?
Yeah, and subsequent to that, it all went quiet for a while, didn't it, on the Jeremy front. There seemed to be a strategy among Labour MPs, I think it was dubbed the silence strategy, which was a form of, I suppose you might call it, passive resistance. But they weren't saying anything either way and leaving him, in their terms, enough rope to hang himself with. And then, yeah, Brexit overwhelmed all other issues. It was almost trans-party as an issue. But I think this conjuncture, this combination of events of Brexit happening and then suddenly two by-elections being thrown up in Labour heartlands, both happening on the same day, even though it would be unfair to hold Corbyn responsible, I think, for a defeat in Stoke, or even despite what Helen says, a defeat in Copeland, the problems that Labour has are bigger than Jeremy Corbyn in those regions. Nevertheless, that won't wash if there are two defeats next Thursday, and his leadership will be a new moment of crisis, I think. And we already saw in the lead up to these by-elections some kind of speculative talk about who might be a suitable leader to follow Jeremy before 2020. So that kind of talk is going to intensify.
Even if Labour does manage to hold their seats in these two by-elections, I just sense there's real problems stacking up for them. If you talk to people who are voting Labour in Copeland, and it's the same in many other northern seats, they don't do so with any enthusiasm or passion. It tends to be, and you'll hear it time and time again, oh, I vote Labour because my dad did, my granddad did, he turned in my grave, you know, in his grave, if I voted any other way. It's sort of, that's in the sort of slightly older generation, it's ingrained. But you talk to young people and that tribal loyalty is just not there anymore. And I haven't had any sense at all in Copeland that Labour is picking up any new votes. It's just people who are just kind of reluctantly clinging on because they've got nowhere else to go.
Well, you can follow all our reporting on the by-elections next week as they happen on theguardian.com/politics. And before then, the Brexit bill reaches the House of Lords next week, and with a clear majority of peers opposed to leaving the EU, it could be a bumpy ride. But having sailed through the Commons with no amendments, peers are being warned in no uncertain terms that their very existence as a part of an upper chamber is at risk if they dare to do anything to block the will of the voters who wanted to leave the EU at the referendum. Now, Alan, is the threat of the Brexit bill being blocked a serious one? And is this the kind of absurd situations that referendums throw up?
Referendums mean that voters have a lot of power, and suddenly parliamentarians have to listen to public views rather more directly than perhaps they have to usually. I mean, I don't think there's any serious prospect that the House of Lords would try to block this bill. Members of the House of Lords can see perfectly clearly the result of the referendum, and they can also see perfectly clearly what the House of Commons did last week. And so I don't think they're going to try to block the bill. What will be interesting is whether they try to amend the bill. And that won't happen next week, because next week is just the second reading debate on the principles of the bill. But maybe in the following week, when they get down into the nitty-gritty, then the House of Lords will try to amend the bill. And there are already various amendments that have been tabled to the bill. And the interesting thing, I think, is in the House of Lords, the government does not have a majority. The Conservatives have just under a third of the seats in the House of Lords. Labour and the Liberal Democrats both have quite a few seats, but they combined don't have a majority either. So really, what we need to be looking at is how many Conservatives and how many crossbench peers are likely to vote in favour of some of these amendments. And it is quite striking that already some quite prominent crossbench peers have put down amendments. So Lord Panic, very prominent lawyer, Lord Hannay, who's a former very senior diplomat, and Lord Kerslake, who was the head of the civil service up to a few years ago, have all put forward amendments. Which might suggest that there is quite a lot of appetite, actually, on the crossbenches for looking quite seriously at this bill and thinking about whether they can get concessions from the government, particularly on the issue of whether parliamentary approval is required before a deal can be done, whether perhaps even a referendum would be required at that stage, and also the issue that raised a lot of concerns in the House of Commons around the position of EU nationals living in the UK and whether their rights can be guaranteed at this early stage.
And Julian, do you think the peers are playing with fire here? How many times do you think they could send this legislation back and forth between the Commons and the Lords in ping pong without delaying it?
Yeah, that was David Davis's phrase, wasn't it? There's going to be a bit of ping pong. I think it's going to be quite a dangerous game of ping pong. And this could well, I think, become the next phase of what one might call our Brexit civil wars. I think Lord Panic, he was one of the enemies of the people in a previous battle over Article 50 and whether Parliament should be required to vote on Article 50. And obviously that the decision that Parliament should vote on Article 50 led to the famous Daily Mail headline. Well, the Daily Mail is not going to be pleased at the prospect of unelected peers deciding that they will amend and modify the will of the people in this fashion. I mean, the two crucial amendments, as Alan has said, EU nationals and final vote, which would precede the votes of the European Commission and the European Parliament. And that will undoubtedly be interpreted by Brexit supporters as a means of diffusing the whole thing at the last fence. And that's not going to be popular. And I think the next couple of weeks, the next two or three weeks are going to see some fairly virulent talk on the Brexit side. And it's going to be interesting for the peers in a whole number of ways. I mean, Labour peers, they don't represent constituencies. They, unlike Labour MPs, they don't have the problem of my constituents voted for Brexit, so how can I hold this up? So they may act with a great deal more liberty, perhaps more freedom than Jeremy Corbyn would want. So I think it is going to be extremely interesting and a little bit toxic, because there's also every chance that if there is this game of ping pong, if the ping pong match lasts, let's say, 3 weeks, then that's going to mean that Article 50 will not be triggered in the first week of March. It may be late March. That will lead to talk about foot dragging and so on. So it's going to be acrimonious, I think.
And Alan, how do you think that the Commons will react to the bill sort of bouncing back to them? Do you think it's in the government's interests to cave voluntarily on any of these points about either EU nationals or a bit more parliamentary scrutiny?
I suspect, actually, the government will think that it can win on all of this, that it managed to get everything through the Commons with quite comfortable majorities, and that it will take the view that it can do the same in the House of Lords as well. And frankly, I think they're probably right. My suspicion would be that the Lords will pass some amendments in a couple of weeks' time, but that those will then be overturned by the Commons after the 7th of March. And the Lords, I would guess, will probably back down fairly quickly at that point. You know, the mood music that we've been getting from people like Baroness Smith, the leader of the Labour peers, is very much that they accept the will of the people in the referendum. They've seen what happened in the Commons last week, and they don't want to block this. And I suspect they will think that that means they don't want to delay it, and they don't want to cause issues with the government's timetable on Article 50 either.
And now, not all the action next week will be up in the upper chamber end of Parliament. There could also be fireworks in the Commons if moves to unseat the Speaker gain any more momentum. So having denounced Donald Trump as a racist and sexist, footage emerged last week of John Bercow discussing in a university Q&A how he opposed Brexit and laying out arguments for remaining in the EU. Julian, do you think he's crossed a line here?
I think to use that language, to talk about Trump being racist and sexist was, let's say, unusual behaviour for someone who occupies a theoretically impartial position within the Houses of Parliament. I would have thought that were it not for his gift and love for self-promotion and a high profile, he could have found other more discreet ways to ensure that Donald Trump did not address the Houses of Parliament. So I think that was a bit of showmanship, which probably deserved to be criticised. But obviously the agenda, there is another agenda which with Bercow, which is that many Tories simply hate him for his leftward journey from the Monday Club to a social liberal who's many suspect is more sympathetic to Labour than the Tories. So they've been gunning for him for so long that they'll use any pretext. But he certainly gave them a pretext, I think.
And Alan, do you think Bercow's overstepped the mark there in terms of his constitutional role as Speaker?
Yeah, I think Julian got that exactly right, really. I mean, he is clearly entitled as Speaker to take a view on whether a visiting head of state can speak and address Parliament, because he is one of the three key holders, as we have now known to refer to them, who are entitled to take a view on that. But I think I think it's very unfortunate that he chose to exercise that position on the basis of his personal view, rather than, I mean, I think he could have stood up and said, I hear the concerns that are being expressed among MPs. I see that more than 200 MPs have signed an early day motion arguing that Trump should not visit Parliament. I've had conversations with many more MPs who don't want to sign the early day motion but share the same concerns. And on that basis, given that a head of state visiting needs to have broad consensual support across the House, in the absence of that, it would seem, at least at present, that he should not speak to Parliament. Had he done it that way, then actually I think it would have been a much more powerful statement, because it would then have been an expression of opinion across the chamber rather than just a personal view. You know, he did, as Julian said, he did very much phrase it as his personal view, which I do think was quite unfortunate, actually.
And Julian, do you think this is anything more than mischief-making from a few backbench Tories? Could he be really facing a serious threat of getting deposed?
I don't think that there will be enough of a groundswell of support for removing him, for him to go. And I mean, crucially, I think he's not popular with Theresa May, but he's not unpopular with Theresa May in the same way that he was with David Cameron and George Osborne, with whom there was a real animus. And I think without clear indications from the top, I don't think that enough votes will be there to get rid of him.
And Alan, do you think it could be very destabilising if the Tory rebels did manage to get rid of John Bercow? What would it mean for Parliament going into quite a difficult, tricky time of more legislation relating to Brexit in the next few months?
Yeah, it would be a very, very divisive thing. And clearly, John Bercow is himself divisive, but ramping up the battle over John Bercow at this time, I think, probably wouldn't help. And as Julian says, I suspect the government would agree with that. David Lidington, in his remarks on this, has been pretty moderate and has, you know, been saying that it's a matter for Parliament, not a matter for government. But the mood coming from him does seem to be one suggesting that this is an issue that they don't particularly want to mess up all the other big debates that are coming ahead.
In the latest episode of Brexit Means, with me, John Henley, we hear from Guy Verhofstadt, the EU Parliament's chief negotiator.
I think that we need even to be generous in a certain way towards the UK citizens. Not UK as such, but UK citizens.
And we look at how Brussels is gearing up for the Brexit talks. Subscribe through iTunes or at theguardian.com/podcasts.
Now, finally this week, Donald Trump's National Security Advisor Michael Flynn lost his job in the White House administration after it emerged he'd been speaking to Russian embassy officials about American sanctions and then lied about doing so to the vice president. It's the latest in a growing list of allegations swirling around the president that involve Russia. And to get a grip on exactly what we know and what we don't, I'm joined by The Guardian's foreign affairs correspondent Luke Harding, a former Moscow correspondent and author of Mafia State. Luke, can you give us the rundown first of what are concrete links between Trump's White House and Putin's Kremlin that are in the public domain?
Well, there are two ways of looking at this. One is the President Trump way, which is this is all fake news. It's a smear. It's a plot. It's bad guys. It's the awful Guardian, New York Times making his life difficult. And the other version is the version we got from the dossier by the former MI6 spy Christopher Steele, which BuzzFeed leaked and published in January, which is a sensational document, essentially saying that the Russians, Putin, his spy agency, had been cultivating Donald Trump for at least 5 years. I think not because they thought that he would necessarily become the next US president, because he would sort of destabilize and undermine the whole kind of US political system. And moreover, that there'd been collusion during the election campaign between Trump people, aides, if you like, and Russian intelligence. And Trump has denied this. The problem is that the facts, as they slowly come out, seem to kind of confirm this version of events. So he lost General Flynn, and I suspect there's more to come.
So how seriously should we be taking this Steele dossier, this document that was put together by the former MI6 agent?
Well, I think some details may be wrong, but I think overall it's pretty plausible. Why wouldn't Russian intelligence try and target Trump? I mean, the question is to what degree, if at all, he cooperated, whether this was merely opportunism on his part. If you remember, he gave that famous speech on the campaign trail last summer where he said, "Russia, if you are listening, hack Hillary Clinton's emails," which sounded to a lot of people like basically incitement for a foreign power to kind of commit espionage against a political opponent. But the problem is there are all these leaks coming from inside the American intelligence community, most recently to the New York Times, essentially saying this week that there were contacts with Russian intelligence. Now, the details are sketchy. These are anonymous sources. We can't be totally confident that this is true. But I think that this scandal isn't going away anytime soon. And looming over it, if you like, is the kind of specter of Watergate. And the big question doing the rounds in Washington now, which is, what did the president know and when did he know it?
So it's possible that it could have been his aides that knew about it, but the knowledge didn't go as far as Trump himself, or is that being too kind to him?
Well, I think that's being a bit too kind. I mean, General Flynn is clearly not the world's greatest diplomat, but you have to ask yourself, when he called the Russian ambassador to Washington in December, at a moment when basically Obama had said that the Kremlin had hacked the US election. And when sort of Flynn basically said, well, actually, when we're in power, we're going to drop sanctions, or we're probably going to drop sanctions. Was Flynn freelancing, or was he actually speaking on behalf of the president with whom he'd had a kind of pre-conversation? Now, we don't know the answer to that, but the problem that Trump faces is that he's really made a lot of people inside the intelligence community fed up, and they are sifting through transcripts. They're sifting through intercept material. They're looking at phone records. They're looking at planes zigzagging across Europe. They are looking at people that they've identified as Russian assets. And all of this could fall on the president's head.
So what's the mechanism for investigating all of this? Is Congress going to do anything about it, or is it up to the media to keep exposing what's happening?
Well, he's under siege on two fronts. First of all, I would say the media, so us included, The Guardian, The New York Times, The Washington Post, if I'm honest, we're pretty invigorated by all this stuff. I mean, I get out of bed with a zing in my step because this is the most compelling political story for a generation, in my view. But also, he's facing pressure from Congress at the moment, more from Democrats than Republicans. Republicans seem very keen to shut this down. But I think there will be several investigations. Definitive they are, how much material we get, whether they can kind of subpoena witnesses like Flynn, for example, under oath, we don't know. But this is shaping up for a classic, massive, rambunctious scandal. And I really can't wait for the next episode.
What about the rest of the world? Do you think Russia could have been influencing elections in Europe? And could it be looking to influence votes in France and Netherlands and Germany?
Well, if you listen to the Kremlin, they say no. They say this is a ridiculous smear. But if you listen to other European states, they say yes, particularly those in the Baltics. There's been a long history of the Kremlin doing this kind of stuff. There was a famous hack of Estonia back in 2008, where basically government systems were shut down and paralyzed. We had a hack in the German parliament where German intelligence agencies are saying they think it was Russia. There are fears that there might be an attempt to influence the French election and to boost Marine Le Pen, who let's not forget, has already taken a 9.4 million euro loan from a Moscow bank. So there's a lot of support going on. The purpose here, I think, is essentially to undermine the European Union. Putin was delighted by Brexit. He hates multilateralism. He prefers doing deals with weaker sovereign nations. And so his kind of agenda is clear. And I think the problem is the West. I mean, I hate that phrase, but Western nations are struggling to figure out how they respond to all this, to this kind of multi-layered campaign involving propaganda, involving trolls, involving fake news, involving subversion, involving hacking, involving, allegedly, though Julian Assange would dispute this, WikiLeaks as a kind of platform for releasing all this material. And so we're in a new game. It's the Cold War, but kind of rebooted for the 21st century. And it's fascinating. But also, I think for those who believe in democracy, it's also pretty scarifying.
Well, thank you very much, Luke. That's all for this week. And my thanks also to Helen, Julian and Alan. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Romina Mason. Thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace. If you want to build a website, you have many options. But if you want to build it beautiful, there's only one. Squarespace gives you the power of world-class design, so you can do more than create a website. You can set yourself apart. See why some of the world's most influential people, brands, and businesses choose Squarespace. To start your free trial, visit squarespace.com/Guardian.